The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. It's good to be back.
Well, I'm looking forward to the conversation. This is our congressional update show.
Yep.
What's going on with regard to acquisition on the Hill, the NDAA, and I'm just going to get started and ask you what's going on.
Well, my focus for the last 6 months has really been around the issues in the National Defense Authorization Bill, which is chugging its way through the process. The committees, both House and Senate, came out of the box relatively early this year and got their bills marked up by middle of June. And the Senate actually got their bill on and off the floor in June, which is a first for them for several years. And they've been in conference ever since. It looked like last week they would finish up the bill. They were getting down to the last few issues, and then apparently they had a disagreement about the greater sage grouse and the status of that bird as an endangered species out west, and couldn't reach agreement, and that essentially blew up the conference, I think, for at least for now. I think they come back after the election, and they'll probably finish that up. I would expect to see the language either late November or early December. We also have the continuing resolution in the appropriations process, which is working right now. There apparently are still a couple of issues which the sides can't reach agreement. I think it's mainly in the area of policy writers. I think they've worked the numbers out. The Senate is hoping to get the bill up and actually release the bill and so we can actually see what's in it. I don't think there's much risk at this point of any sort of government shutdown or anything like that. I think that would just be politically devastating for folks. So I don't think there's any chance that that happens. But they are still working out the issues on the policy riders. So those are the two main things. And, of course, in the Defense Authorization Bill, we have more acquisition policy provisions, if you combine all the language in both bills, than we have ever had, I think, in a National Defense Authorization Act process.
Really?
Yeah. I even went back to and counted the provisions. The year we did separate bills in 1993 for the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act, which was a separate bill, and then we also had acquisition policy issues in the National Defense Authorization Act that year. And if you add all those provisions up, we have even more this year. I counted about 180-some provisions. But I think there are a number of things there that they're trying to look at, and I would sort of group all of these things under the general heading of innovation. And how do we open up the defense acquisition process to more innovative ideas and the ability to acquire new technologies, new capabilities, and get them deployed more rapidly from different sectors maybe than we have traditionally been getting the ideas through. And that goes in every way from how we look at commercial item acquisition to the treatment of contractors under the contract administration process with business process systems, as well as the cost accounting standards, to how do we organize the acquisition enterprise in the department to focus more of the high-level management attention on front-end sort of innovation, front-end research and engineering. And it's interesting because both houses have taken sort of somewhat different approaches, but I think they can all be understood looking at things through that innovation lens.
So just before you go and address, I think it sounds like you're going to go address a little bit about the two sort of approaches. Could just remind the listeners, like, why all this focus on, you know, provisions to address innovation? Good. What's driving that?
Yeah, I think if you step back and look at the conversation that we've been having in the national security arena, I would say especially over the last year and a half, 2 years, there have been a lot of concerns about the degree to which the United States is maintaining its technology edge vis-a-vis potential adversaries around the world, especially given changes in the marketplace, the availability of technologies, as well as the budgets and the capability of our potential adversaries. And I think there's a real worry that we have a system that doesn't move fast enough to take advantage of some of the things that are out there and the things that we need to take advantage of if we're to maintain our battlefield superiority. the perception is that we're sort of living off of the what they call the second offset. Sort of changes the network-centric kind of approaches that we really developed in the 70s and 80s.
Right, that's like precision-guided munitions
and things like that, right. And I think the sort of the third offset future technologies, I think that it's a lot less clear that we're ahead or that we have a system in place that can actually pull those technologies into programs and you know, keep them refreshed, as it were.
Sure.
I think, if, for example, if you look at the main thrust of Better Buying Power 3.0, I think it's that concern driving a lot of the recommendations, such things as some of the proposals on independent research and development by contractors, as well as the ideas on major defense acquisition programs of getting the intelligence community much more integrated into that process so that system requirements can be really driven in real time to a much greater extent by changing threats and changing opportunities that might be out there. So this has been a conversation that we've been having, given the fact that the legislation regulates so much of the acquisition process. It was just a matter of time before Congress really started getting into the act. And it was already some of the discussion that we had last year around, for example, the commercial item acquisition changes that were included in last year's bill. So this has been a sort of something that's been building, but I think this year it's really come to a head.
Yeah, you covered all the bases there. I guess really, like, how do we get Google or Apple or somebody like that with new ideas, like the whole Silicon Valley sort of recruitment effort by DOD? This is manifesting itself in legislation now, right?
Right, correct. Yeah, so. That's correct. And again, I think it's being driven by a couple of things. On the one hand, I mentioned concern about the threat in the national security environment around the world. I think the other issue, obviously, that's driving it not only for the Department of Defense, but also for the other federal agencies, are the pressures in the budget, especially as we, you know, go from year to year with the caps on that the Budget Control Act has put in place on agency spending. So I think there are a lot of different factors that are sort of driving this. And I also think that you're having in the private sector, in different areas, especially in electronics and information technology and communications, different ways of deploying technologies, different ways of combining things, putting things together in sort of value package propositions that really is very different, I think, than the way the department has been used to.
Or just any government agency.
Exactly,
right? Yeah.
Exactly. So I think all of those things are sort of bringing this to a head. I don't think we're done having this conversation this year. I think it has another 1 or 2 years to run, I think, before folks are satisfied that they've done everything to align the legislative framework around acquisition with what they think the future needs are. And there's some disagreements, obviously, about how best to do that.
Yeah, it seems to me, if you think about it, but the rate of technological change and capability, and how things are delivered for, and how information is delivered and managed, it's just the gap between what is available and what people can do now versus what the government has access to just seems to get bigger and bigger, right?
I mean,
the whole, the cloud and all the trying to access that and that sort of thing seems to me, I mean, that's all recognizing, there's opportunities here to really make a big difference.
Right. And to what extent do we have specific government unique requirements that are absolutely essential to protect the taxpayers' interest, the integrity of the process, and to also to cater adequately to the security that we need in these acquisitions? And how much of that do we have to have layered on top of any process in order to, give us the levels of security and integrity that we need, and how much can be dispensed with, and to what extent can we let, the market, determine
or drive
some of the,
that.
Yeah, drive
right.
that a little
yeah.
bit. And that's been a long-standing debate. I think now it's sort of been shifting, though, as the private sector has really been proliferating these different models for delivering capability as well as some of the capabilities that are emerging. So
yeah, and John, we're already up on the first break. When we come back, I guess we'll talk about what's in these, this various versions and what they may or may not mean for folks out there in both government contractors and government as well. My guest today is John Etherton. He's the president of Etherton & Associates, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. I spent 18 years, is that right, John, on the Hill?
Yes.
Senate Armed Services Committee, primarily.
14 years.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And John is one of the leading thinkers, to me, in my view. I'm giving you a compliment here, John.
All right, thank you.
On government procurement and even just government in general and how it operates, the management of it, you know, what drives motivations for organizations. It's always fascinating to sit down and have a cup of coffee or a cup of tea with John. But back to our topic. I've praised you enough, so let's get back to it. But one of the things based, the conversation in the first segment about access to innovation and the focus on that, I just wanted to get your thoughts. In the cyber area, how is the government going about it from your perspective? Is it, again, looking to government-driven solutions, or is the government laying out what its requirements are and then saying, bring to us whatever your commercial latest, greatest invention is that can meet this? How is that shaping out?
Well, I think it's a number of different things. I think for folks that are in the government space that are doing business with the Department of Defense or other federal agencies, you're seeing more and more standards being promulgated for information security and information assurance. Some of them, when we had the big FAR rule, the cybersecurity rule that will fully take effect on December next year, which lays out a number of requirements for, information under government contracts. There was a recent rule that was published by the National Archive and Records Administration, which laid out a number of standards for critical, or I forget what the C stands for, but the unclassified information that's out there. And so far that only applies internally, but clearly to the extent that you have contractors interacting with that information.
Managing that information.
Managing for the government, it will be part of what they have to deal with. I think we're going to see a progressive unveiling of standards applying to different information that may be out there in the contractors' networks that will be specific to government. But part of me wonders, and this is more of a wonderment than anything else, as we have more and more evidence of hacks of various companies' information in their databases and the impacts of that in terms of insurance liabilities and other kinds of things, I wonder to what extent the private sector insurance companies will drive similar regimes for all companies, irrespective of whether they sell to the government or not. And if we are maybe in a situation when sort of the longer term where we may not have a convergence of requirements that apply just as sort of a general matter in the private sector and how they protect information, that may sort of alleviate this government unique versus non-government set of standards and make it easier for companies to do business with the government, or at least remove that particular obstacle for them. So I've asked people around, just in companies, and I haven't talked to the insurance companies, but I've wondered if, in fact, some of that work will be done as liabilities are clearer and requirements are clearer and capabilities are clearer, that may be enough to address some of the specific government requirements that are currently underway.
And then there's just the protecting your trade secrets and, the threats to your business in and of itself, whether it's cyber espionage, that focuses on government, but also it's an industrial espionage, right? For technologies and capabilities across the board. I mean, you could see where, obviously, right, the imperative is to become more secure. So turning to the current legislation on the Hill, can you give us some of the highlights? What's going on in this time?
Well, as I said, I think there are a number of different themes at work. And if you look at the provisions in the House and Senate bills. But as I said in the first segment, I think innovation and access to innovation is the primary theme driving a lot of what you see in both House and Senate versions of the bill. And most of this language is in Title 8, although in the House bill, they have a very robust Title 17, which is their approach to innovation and major programs, which is worth talking about. I mean, the House, that's been this year, the major focus is how do they figure out a pathway to allow for innovation and refreshment of technology and capabilities within a program in a way that, number one, allows for this to occur as a natural part of the program acquisition cycle, but at the same time puts the programs in a position where they don't have to bet the program on a particular technology outcome, so that you set up a process that would essentially allow you to take higher risk technologies offline, have a pathway for those to be developed, have them in some sense synchronized with the needs of these emerging major programs, and then having a process for actually deploying a capability into a program and getting it integrated. And so their approach, which is something that the Department of Defense has been working with now for several years, is to really step up the idea of using sort of these open systems architecture approaches to systems design and systems architecture and acquisition strategy. So they have language essentially which would require that for each major new start after 2019, they would require that modular open systems architecture be sort of the featured design approach, whether it's for the entire system or significant parts of it or wherever. And they've put some definitions in place of what that means, what that would look like. There's a great deal of reliance on using open interfaces as part of that process. And then they've provided a number of tools for the program manager to use with specific limitations in terms of time and funding, which would allow them to take this authority and develop various capabilities or you know, components or modules or whatever you want, using sort of a platform-centric approach, but having it use a open systems architecture to allow for the integration of things down the road, and maybe even the removal of some things and the substitution of higher capabilities. I think there are a number of issues that this language will raise, even if it's, you know, worked out and massaged to the point where everybody is satisfied with the language on the books. You have issues on standards and who is going to pay for the development of those standards and how will you prioritize and make sure that those open standards are available when you need them. I think that's one issue. I think is equally a critical issue, in my opinion, is the role of the systems integrator, because I don't believe personally from the folks that I've talked to that simply having an open systems architecture with open interfaces is necessarily going to be enough to ensure.
Yeah, it's not a panacea.
Yeah, it's
right.
Not a panacea. So that integrating, you know, various capabilities, you really need to have a heavy, early and constant involvement of systems integration of folks, whether it's on the government side or the industry side, to ensure that that strategy is really viable. And that will take some people. It'll take people with different capabilities, different training. It'll take funding, I think, for, you know, the development of standards or the ability to work with standard-setting organizations in the private sector. So I think it brings with it a lot of pieces that, and if you look at the report language in the House bill accompanying the language, they recognize this and basically, you know, require a fairly robust set of plans to sort of address some of these issues before the requirement actually goes into place. I think it was very prudent for the House folks to, you know, set a 2019 start date for this to give everybody enough time to sort of work out a lot of the details on how it would work. There already is a very vigorous effort in the Department of Defense that they've got a handbook on modular open systems architecture, which is quite extensive and very detailed. There are a number of other issues that come up that they've already started to recognize, especially in the question of data rights and intellectual property, which, again, the House also addressed in their bill language. But this is, I think, the major focus of what you're seeing coming out of the House is this question of how do we provide for making sure that our weapons programs, which can stretch out over 20 or 30-year life cycles, how we can ensure that they have the most up-to-date technologies and the most up-to-date capabilities. So that's an interesting set of issues. I don't think the House approach has necessarily been that controversial from what I could tell in talking to the conference folks. And the Senate actually had a modular open systems architecture provision as well in their bill, although their bill was not system-centric or platform-centric. What they wanted to do was to basically encourage or direct the use of modular open systems architecture across systems so that it would be outside the boundaries of the systems that would enable the systems to work together. So there's a little bit of a convergence there in thinking, a little bit of a...
Sounds like the House is more targeted and they could come together on that.
Right? Yeah, right. I don't think there's any major issue of knitting together those, although, you know, they use different concepts. They assign responsibilities to different places, and I think having that all integrated and organized, you know, it's been a little bit of a task for them to work that out over the summer.
Well, John, we have to take our next break. My guest today is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and when we come back, we'll continue our discussion of what's in the current versions of the NDAA as they work through the conference. And then we'll also turn a little bit to what's going on right now. Some of the, we're already seeing, like from last year's NDAA, the rollout of the Section 813 panel and the Section 809 panel, and John's going to give us an update on those. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And John, when we took the break, you had provided some insights with regard to open architecture and what's going on in the, you know, in the Senate version of the NDAA and the House version. I know there's plenty of other stuff in there as well, and the focus on innovation. One thing I wanted to ask you about specifically, you know, there's a, you know, some discussion and some language around bid protests and potentially in GAO's role. What's being contemplated there?
Well, there are two provisions at play here. One is a provision in the House bill in Title VIII, which actually looks for a study to look at the extent to which folks can determine what the impact of the bid protest process is on the broader acquisition process. Is it slowing things down? Are people exploiting some of the features of it in ways that are, you know, not helpful, I guess, to the system? There's specific language in there, for example, dealing with the degree to which incumbents use the bid protest process to delay, you know, contracts going into effect so that they can get a bridge contract or whatever to keep performing on a program, and how widespread that is that, you know, becoming more systematic. I think the Senate, though, has taken a more radical approach. In their language, they essentially would put a series of loser pay provisions in place, which would essentially say that the current process can continue to work as is, but if you file a protest and as a contractor, none of the elements of that protest are sustained by the Government Accountability Office, then you're subject to paying, you know, various costs to GAO as well as to the contractor that actually won the contract, if it's another contractor, or actually, you know, funding to the Rapid Prototyping Fund or to GAO or whatever. So there would be penalties levied if you lose. Now, there are a few questions that this raises. Number one is, what do you do in cases where you have someone who files a protest, the agency looks at the procurement when they're asked about it by GAO and realizes that they made a mistake or, you know, didn't do everything the way they felt they should have, and they decide to do it over again or withdraw the solicitation or the award or whatever? GAO never makes a formal finding in many of those cases, and so you know, everybody just kind of says, never mind. Well, and under this language in the Senate bill, the company would still have to pay, which I don't think anybody intended that kind of an outcome. So there are a number of those kind of questions. And I think the other issue is, to the extent that GAO gets money as sort of part of a penalty for filing a protest that it isn't sustained in any way, does that represent a conflict of interest for them? And how would you work that out?
You never win. Pay me.
Right, exactly. So there are those issues, I think. I mean, I think the bigger issue, Roger, is the extent to which the bid protest process serves as a proxy for companies to deal with the other issues in the acquisition process that maybe the processes aren't working as well as they should. The one thing I hear, and I'm sure it's fairly widespread, is about debriefings, that agencies, you know, companies feel that they don't get an adequate debriefing if they lose on a procurement. And they feel like filing a protest is the only way that they can get full information on exactly what happened and on why they didn't win. That's really not a protest issue. That's an issue with the debriefing process.
It's a communication issue.
It's a communication issue, and it's a process issue. And debriefings are already provided for in law. So maybe that's the area that we need to look at rather than looking at the protest process. There are also, similarly, the protest process does serve as a check on agency procurement. As I mentioned, the agency may look at the details of a protest and realize that they made a mistake and they want to go back and do something over, do it differently. Well, there ought to be a way outside of the protest process, perhaps, for agencies to respond to those type of things as the procurements are ongoing, that would probably cut down on the number of protests for those reasons. And so I think, you know, to set up this fairly big change in the protest process to address those kinds of issues doesn't really address those issues. It does raise some other questions. Now, the Senate language does exempt small business from the loser pay provisions. And so there's, you know, that is one of the concerns that they did try to address in the language. But I suspect, personally feel, that there is probably another layer of insight analysis that we need to go through before we result to such a fundamental change to the bid protest process as requiring the loser to pay in the event that a protest is not sustained. But we'll see what the, I don't know where that issue has come out. It will be interesting to see where.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that step one would be a study and review of what's going on to identify, you know, what would be the appropriate actions to take to address what was found in, you know, in any kind of review or study, right?
I mean, right. But it does raise the issue, the bigger issue, getting back to the subject of innovation, of, you know, this is a unique process that's available in government acquisition. It's generally that you don't have, you can't protest losing, you know, not getting a contract or whatever in the private sector. There aren't any rules that constrain what the folks can do like that. So the question is this a different feature of the process that has some impact on the willingness of companies who are not currently doing business with the federal government to play, knowing that this could be an additional feature and could inject some additional time, even if a company wins, you know, a bid or something like that. So that, I think, you know, it sort of fits into this larger theme that you see throughout the Senate language in Title VIII, which is, you know, do we have a process with these various elements in it that is so different and has so many different requirements than similar processes that might be among private sector parties, that we need to really take a look at how do we lessen the burden potentially of these things so that we make this a more attractive marketplace for people that are not currently doing business with the federal government. So you see the bid protest approach, and I think the way I've described it is one way of looking at it. There's also language, for example, in the Senate bill, which would provide for a more flexible use of cost accounting standards. They would actually set up a Department of Defense cost accounting standards board to basically expedite things that are specifically addressable to DOD. But also in this language, there is provisions which would exempt companies from cost accounting standards that have a lower threshold of cost type contracts or that are non-traditional companies. And in many cases, they allow for companies to use non-government processes to actually address some of the cost accounting standard issues, so that to the extent that they are using private sector or sort of the normal government account or generally accepted accounting principles, they can rely on those instead of the specific cost accounting standards. Now, I think there are a number of issues that that raises, especially when you do have a universe of cost type contracts. But I think there's been a good discussion around a lot of those issues. But it does raise the question, even for companies that are the more traditional defense contractors, to what extent they should be given permission to use sort of normal, generally accepted practices in accounting or other areas, or Sarbanes-Oxley or things like that, to rely on those processes rather than having to have those processes in addition to the processes that are, right, are specific, yep, to government contracts. Similarly, there's language addressing this issue of executive orders and to what extent companies should be subject to the executive orders by virtue of the fact that they're government contractors. Probably the most controversial piece of that is the executive order on fair pay and safe workplace, which is scheduled to go into effect government-wide next month. There is language in both the House and Senate bills exempting at a minimum the Department of Defense companies from that, and cutting that back in several significant ways. It's been politically very controversial, and I don't think they've resolved the issue yet. I think they're going to continue to hammer that, but I think that's another area where, again, folks are looking at specific government unique requirements that may not apply to companies, you know, doing business, you know, in the private sector. That, I think, is more of a feature of the Senate bill, is that they've gone through and they've looked at the business process rule and some of the requirements specifically for business process. They've looked at the cost accounting standards. They've looked at the treatment of companies as commercial contractors and the goods and services as commercial items, and provided much greater flexibility to allow companies to use, if they have commercial customers for things, to use a lot of the same rules and systems and pricing and things like that that they provide for commercial customers, even that same workforce, without, sure, having to be covered under these government unique requirements.
Well, it seems to me that if you're going to do that for, quote, non-traditionals, why don't you lift all boats by doing, right, the same thing for, and I think you get bigger return on it.
Potentially, and that's been one of the big debates. I mean, I think that the Senate approach seems to suggest that we could end up with sort of a two-tiered process or,
yes,
system.
Yeah.
And you've got one group of companies that have very light burdens, and you have other group of the more traditional companies which have very heavy burdens which drive their overhead expense. And by doing so, are you creating an unlevel playing field?
Right, competing for the same requirement.
Exactly.
Right.
So how do you, you know, basically sort of square all this with the view of having a more flexible process and at the same time not creating sort of two classes of companies that you're dealing with on a regular basis.
Right, and it's not a sort of natural competitive advantage based on something that you've developed. It's a government statutory regulatory advantage that's being created there.
Right, exactly, right? Exactly. Yeah.
John, we're already up on our break. So I guess when we come back, maybe a couple more things, but I do want to get to the panels and get an update on the Section 809 panel and the Section 813 panel. My guest today is John Etherton. He is the president of Etherton Associates, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton and Associates. And John, I know you covered, you know, the big themes of the bills and some of the specifics as well. And there's one area that I would be remiss as a good host if I didn't ask you about, and that's, you know, there's language about potentially reorganizing AT&L a little bit. Can you tell us about that?
Well, one of the other issues in the bill is they're revisiting the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which was passed in 1986. And although this was not part of the Goldwater-Nichols Act, it was part of that process. We actually did it in the National Defense Authorization Act separately, but is the creation of the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition Technology and Logistics. And whether there is some advantage to be gained in the cause of innovation by splitting up that office into two parts. One would be an undersecretary of research and engineering, which would focus basically on the entire acquisition process for major programs, but would also be in charge of looking at research and engineering and the innovation side and new technologies and things, and making that more of a focus without running sort of the entire acquisition process, the contract administration process, and other things, which would be organized under a different undersecretary. That's interesting. I think one of the other motivating issues about this, and it was present last year in the discussion last year as well, is the idea of these organizations in the Office of the Secretary of Defense maybe getting very large and having a sort of a function-by-function mentality in terms of oversight. I don't know how that one is going to come out. I think that, in my opinion, if folks are really concerned about research and engineering and the research enterprise and getting more focus, I personally think that could be accommodated within the existing organizational structure. But it is not a trivial challenge, even to try to do that. I've had some discussions with some of the folks on the Hill about that since the language came out. But that is an issue, and it's been very controversial. There's very strong opposition coming from the Department of Defense to that idea. And we'll see sort of how they do it. I'm not sure that you can do a completely clean break that doesn't end up sort of severing something that you may want to have integrated into the major program acquisition structure. But there is an attempt by the Senate to do that in a way that really has sort of the functional administrative kinds of things in acquisition. Although one of them is very interesting is they would move the Defense Contract Audit Agency, which is currently operating out of the Comptroller's Office, and move that over to this new undersecretary and have it as part of the acquisition enterprise, which raises a number of other different issues. So I know that's been a big issue under debate. They may have decided it. I don't know. But again, I think it goes back to this innovation and how do we focus on innovation.
Right. I'm listening to the description. I'm thinking, when do you look at your organization to see internally yourself how it should be structured? Does it currently meet, you know, mission needs, or can there be changes made? I mean, I know one of the things they're focusing on now, right, is hiring lots of cost analysts, right, and price analysts, right, in the view that they're addressing a shortcoming from earlier, you know, decisions that were made.
Right.
So, I mean, that's an interesting dynamic there. So I have to bring up the panels. The Section 809 panel first. What is that, John?
Well, the Section 809 panel grew out of recommendations from a number of different organizations. I was involved, as you remember, with the NDIA Pathway to Transformation Study in 2014. Yep. And we had recommended in our recommendations that the Congress charter sort of another Section 800 panel, similar to what we had in the 1991 Defense Authorization Act, which would basically do a review of statutes that had been passed that deal with acquisition policy. There had not been a sort of a systematic review of that since the early 1990s, and a lot of legislation has been passed. That basically got morphed or transformed a little bit through the congressional process into the Section 809 panel. And what they wanted the panel to look at is, instead of focusing on statutes, they want them to focus on regulation. So that panel has been seated. It's I think my understanding is they're going to try to do as much of their business in a public forum as they can. And they're now sort of putting their work product together. They've got a difficult job.
It's a big job.
Because you have to, you can't just say we're going to look at all regulation. You've got the FAR, you've got in, just in DOD, the Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement. You've got other things which are quasi-regulatory, which may bear on the process, the PGI mm-hmm. and other things like that. So they've got to basically, I think, look at things on an issue, organize around certain issues.
Yeah, we talk about contract duplication. It's like policy duplication.
Right.
With, I mean, all the different layers of guidance and direction that's in writing that, you know, and just making sense of all that.
And one of the big motivations that the folks in Congress said they had for choosing to do this with regulation, recognizing the scoping issue would be huge, instead of doing statute, is that, that they want to get a better understanding of the degree to which the regulations have departed from the statute, or there's daylight between what the statute requires or recommends, and the way the regulations that implement them have evolved, and maybe some of the collateral regulations around that. And they wanted to make sure that that was part of the review. My understanding is they've given the panel pretty broad leeway into how they want to organize their efforts. And I think that over the next couple of months, I think we're going to get a lot more insight into
they're really just getting started,
but they've got some really, really great folks as members, as some people that have been involved in the acquisition process for a long time. I think they're very well resourced at the Defense Acquisition University, and I think there's a desire to do something that really is more groundbreaking than simply, you know, being another study. So I'm hopeful.
The resources are a huge deal based on our
experience on the SARA panel.
Yeah, resources make a big difference. So Section 813 or the 813 panel.
Yes, the 813 panel has a much more specific charter. They have been tasked to look at 10 USC in the statute, 10 USC 2320 and 2321, which are the intellectual property statutes that apply to Department of Defense contracts, and to make recommendations to change them. Their time frame is probably going to be more through the end of this year and maybe a little bit into early next year as they're looking at some of those issues. So they've got a very specific focus. I've worked a little bit with the panel in providing some background information. I did a compendium of all the statutory, the initial statute creating 10 U.S.C. 2321, and then as well as the changes, the succession of changes that have taken place since that was created in 1984. To try to get some sense of where the trends and trajectories and the legislative history. You've got a very well-constructed group of industry people and government people, many different imperatives driving the different stakeholders, trying to sort through the issues, trying to understand really where the pressure points and the tension points are. A lot of their information is actually, they are covered by the Federal Advisory Committee Act. So they have their meetings are pretty
public,
much public
and
meetings, and I've attended them all so far. And they really are digging into this in a big way, and really exposing sort of where the tension points are between the government and industry, what the needs are, the various places where these issues become more acute. And I'm expecting, you know, to see a very thoughtful product from them. I don't know, you know, what recommendation changes they'll make or anything else.
Is this the idea of like we've got to get innovation?
It's to incentivize innovation, but there's another.
But while protecting or meeting legitimate government needs,
and especially in sustainment and logistics. I think that's where the main conversation has come in from the government side. That they be in a position where they can, in a cost-effective manner, and with having different options and alternatives, that they are in a position to sustain programs that may be and systems that may be in service for 30 years. And that's a really tough challenge, and I think, for them, because so much of the time when the government is having the conversations around data rights and need and licensing agreements or whatever the case might be, it's very difficult to necessarily project with a great deal of clarity exactly what all those needs are going to be out, you know, into those out years. And so that's a real challenge. There've been a number of other discussions around that, but yet you do have situations where you want to attract people to bring innovative ideas in and come up with ways that, for example, things that are incorporated in major systems or whatever through modular open systems architecture, whatever the case might be, that you have a regime that doesn't preclude you from being able to work with producers of a lot of different solutions.
Right. I got time for one more quick question. Okay. Do you see this focus on innovation continuing into the next Congress and, you know, and beyond?
I do. I think next year there will be as much conversation about it as what we're having now. I don't know, obviously, if whatever legislative changes are put in place, there's going to be a minimum nine-month lag before you see implementing instructions or regulations. But I think folks are going to be looking at anything preliminarily. The intellectual property folks are going to be coming back with whatever recommendations they choose to make early next year. I think that becomes part of the conversation. So, yes. And then, of course, we'll have a new administration and the transition that'll be also taking place, and that may have some organizational implications. I don't know. There are already some things that in law now, as far as reorganization, will go into effect in February if they're not changed. So I think, yes, I think next year this is going to be as big an issue as this year.
And, well, John, thank you so much for being on the show. My guest today has been John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.